Love and Beauty in St. John of the Cross with Father Matthew Blake. Talk to.
So we began last night with a little introduction to John of the Cross, looking at a little bit of his teaching on prayer. And I said I want to pick up more specifically John of the Cross as Doctor of the Church. That's the kind of context of this retreat, where in 1926, 100 years ago, John was declared a Doctor of the Church, which was the 200th anniversary of his canonization in 1726. And this title, Doctor of the Church, I think is 38 people so far in the 2000 years of Christianity have that title. Approximately, I think it's about 38, maybe 39. The most recent one being John Henry Newman, of course, in the past few months. And to be Doctor of the Church, there are basically three requirements, according to what. The first one is the person has to be holy, a saint. They have to be a canonized saint, even though there was an exception to that some years ago when Pope Benedict announced that he was making Hildegard of Bingen a Doctor of the Church. Whether he had omitted or forgotten that she wasn't a canonized saint, she was canonized rather quickly, I think, to fulfill that requirement. It's not that anybody questioned the holiness of the woman. So holiness is the first requirement. The second one then is their teachings, their teachers, the doctrine that they teach. We'll come back to that in a few minutes. And the third requirement is the church has to declare this as a decision of the church. And what that more specifically means is that it's not an award, so to speak, if we put it like that. It's not the Nobel Prize for doctrine or Christian teaching. It is an act of the church to proclaim and to further its proclamation of the gospel. In other words, there are always going to be reasons why the church takes that decision now. So the church's decision a few months ago to declare John Henry Newman as Doctor of the Church was not to reward him for what he did 100 years ago. It was to fulfill some need of the church today, or to enhance the message that the church wants to proclaim to the world today. So in 1926, there were very particular reasons why the church chose to declare John of the Cross a Doctor of the Church. And I just want to pick up a little on that now. Why would 1926, the 1920s, why would this be such the right moment? Because people have been speaking about John of the Cross as a Doctor of the Church more or less from after the time he died. There were calls for us, and all the way along there were calls for us. And I just want to pick up a little from a witness from those times, the Carmelite, his now blessed Marie-Eugène Grillot, French. And in 1927, he was giving a retreat to the Carmelite nuns in Lisieux. And I want to look briefly at a little paragraph from that retreat. So he's there in Lisieux, to the Carmelite nuns, the community that Saint Therese had lived in. Three of her sisters are there among the community that he's speaking about, Pauline, Mary, and Céline. Three of them are still living. They're still in the community. And the community, many of whom would have lived with Therese. And he's giving the retreat in the days leading up to the Feast of John of the Cross in 1927. And he's very much focusing upon John of the Cross as Doctor of the Church. And it gives us a unique insight into the thinking of the time. he's already spoken a little bit about the giving of this title, Doctor of the Church, and what that means. And he makes the point that this would not have been possible 100 years ago, he said. And even 40 years ago, the church actually turned it down. That was Pope Leo XIII said no, 40 years previously to this. And so Mario Genas poses the question, well, what has changed in 40 years? Clearly, there has been a world war, and that changed so much. So much else has changed in the whole world of Christianity and spirituality, and all of that has changed. But the biggest change that he sees is the emergence of St. Therese of Lisieux, this member of the community that he is speaking to. And so many people have come to know her, and he's very much a witness to this, because in the First World War, he was a French soldier and rose up to be quite a high-ranking French soldier. And he witnessed in the trenches this book by this saint being passed around among the soldiers. In fact, it was passed around at both sides during the war. She's not yet beatified or canonized. That'll come in 1923 and 1925, just before this. But this book was being passed, and he personally saw the effect that this book was having on so many of the soldiers and how lives were being changed there. So he's very much a witness to this. By now, of course, she has been both beatified and canonized in record speed. So he tells us that God brought these two masters of the science of love before presenting them to us in the same light. St. John of the Cross was, for St. Therese, the most beloved of fathers, indeed, the father of her soul. And he quotes a line from her autobiography. Between the ages of 17 and 18, I had no other spiritual nourishment. Therese, of course, is already a Carmelite nun at this stage. It's a very critical time in her spiritual growth. Marie Eugène goes on to say, at this crucial period, she found in the writings of the saint the light, the audacious confidence that launched her along these waves of love. So he's attributing to her very much, making John of the Cross new. In a sense, we could say what he is doing is something like this. He's holding up the life, the witness of Therese in one hand, and he's holding up the writings of John of the Cross in the other. Therese is, and he'll go on to say this, Therese is very much the personification, the putting into flesh, into real living, the writings of John of the Cross. She has lived John's writings to great depths, depths perhaps never known before. And her life, her experience, the power of her witness illustrates for us what is here in the writings of her spiritual father, John of the Cross. So he attributes to her this sort of renewed interest there is in spirituality. In the first decades of the 20th century, there was a renewed interest in spirituality. Clearly, it wasn't all coming from Therese and the experience that people have of Therese. There were a whole number of other factors. But it gave rise to what has become known in history as the mystical movement, that interest in mysticism, in spirituality, that was very much there the early part of the 20th century, particularly the years between the two world wars. And so the church wants to respond to that. And no better way can the church respond to that than to hold up John of the Cross as being the teacher, the sure guide to this maze, this world of spirituality, this world of mysticism that so many people are becoming interested in, but also can become misguided and things can be misinterpreted. So John of the Cross is needed. And in declaring him a doctor of the church is very much responding to a real need that it perceived was there in 1926. So that element is very important in the choice. And as we said, even 40 years before that, the church took the opposite view. Many of you were here last year when we spoke about Edith Stein. And of course, very much at that stage, there was a request being presented to Rome to declare Edith Stein a doctor of the church. The church has said no to that, said yes to Newman, said no to Edith Stein. Why? I'm not sure. But maybe just like with John of the Cross, no had to be said first, but then maybe yes will come another 40 or 50 years. Maybe Edith Stein might be more needed. Who knows? That's only God knows the answer to that. But it's interesting how these things work. To come back then to the previous, I said, outstanding holiness. John of the Cross's case, of course, there's no doubting of that. Doctrine then, the writings, the teachings of these people. Not only must they expound faithfully the teaching of the church, the teaching of Christianity, be faithful to all that has been taught for the past 2,000 years, but there must also be in their teachings and writings an originality. Something new is probably not the right word, because it's not because it is the same Christian faith that they're proclaiming, but new insights, new depths, new ways of presenting it. Somehow their lives, their experience, their teachings, their writings add something or enhance the church's doctrine and the church's way of understanding and communicating that doctrine. So there must be an originality. They're not just repeating what everybody else has said down through the centuries. It is not simply, as I've said, an academic knowledge. These are not just good academics. There are many people who are good academics and can speak about theology and all of that without becoming doctors of the church. Here there must be an originality. And that originality, of course, comes from the first requirement, and that is prayer, their own personal relationship with God. Perhaps we could put it something like this. There are two ways of understanding, obviously they complement each other, but there are two ways of understanding and proclaiming the Christian faith. There's what comes from study, research, books, coming to know ever more deeply the tradition that has been passed down to us. That's one side of it. And there is the knowledge, the understanding, the experience that comes from one's personal relationship with God. The insight that comes from personal experience, personal holiness. They complement each other, but they are two distinct sources. Person can come to know at a very profound level without having the language of theology. There are many people who understand theology very profoundly, have never read a theology book. It has come from their prayer lives. There are many people who can clearly explain theology, but haven't got a profound prayer life. In a doctor of the church, the two must come together. And the originality comes from their prayer lives, their experience, their life experience, the experience of living human life in profound relationship with God, and the understanding, the wisdom that comes from that relationship. And that, of course, John of the Cross has in abundance. So the question then comes up, and many people down through the years have tried to answer this question, and maybe there are various answers to it, but where is the originality in John of the Cross's teaching? What is his original contribution? Or what does he give us that helps us in a way that perhaps others haven't? Or what does he give us that enables us to enter more deeply our relationship with God and to understand it with more light, with more clarity? I touched slightly on the first one of these last night, but I want to say a bit more about it now. And that is John's understanding of the human person. John understands human beings very well. We could spend a whole week going to his whole experience of life and growing up and the poverty he grew up in and the tragedy of human life that he came to understand at a very young age, and all the aspects of human life that John understood. But we could define, from the purpose of his teaching, we could perhaps say that John is the expert on the two extremes of that. First of all, he's an expert in what it is that really impoverishes, imprisons, compromises, destroys human life. And for John, that can be very much reduced to the vices, the destructive tendencies that get hold of us. And the words that he particularly liked to use was the word appetites. We might use terms like addictions or attachments, or we might use other terms. But what John means by the appetites is whatever limits and compromises our freedom to be, to decide, to act. Those deep tendencies that are there within us, that are the source of all that damages human life, damages either our own lives or the lives of others around us, or indeed the whole world. Because ultimately all conflicts and all mistreatment of abuse of human beings comes from something there deep within, those deep destructive tendencies that are within us. John explores these very profoundly in his writings, and more importantly, points the way, shows us the route out of these, the route towards true human freedom, the route to a life that is well lived. So, and the other side then of that, the other extreme of that, we might say, is that John is the expert on what it is to live a life, to use his term, in union with God. When a person is truly living a life at rights with God. We saw a little bit of that last night in looking at the prayer of a person like this, how they might approach God. A person who's truly at one with God. And the terms that John would like to express that very much in terms of God who is living within the person. The indwelling of God. A human being in whom God lives. The Father and I will come and make our home in whoever loves us. Those line, that line of John's Gospel, so fundamental to John of the Cross's teaching, quotes in his prologue to The Living Flame. And John says to us there, very simply, but very profoundly, Jesus said this. Jesus is God. And if he says so, not only is it true completely, it's not exaggeration, it's totally true that the Father, the Son, and Holy Spirit will come and live, make their home in whoever loves them. John goes on to say that that means much more than we could ever understand or imagine. Whatever we think that means, whatever we might understand it to mean, the reality is something much greater. And so John tries to, he cannot express that reality because it's outside the limits of anything that words or beautiful poetry or art could ever express. But he at least makes an attempt to point us in that direction, that God living within. In other words, what he is pointing us towards is the reality of we're made in the image and likeness of God. We can grow into that. What might that be? What might it look like? What might be the experience of this person? So John then explores the reality of the human being in all its dimensions, pushing to both extremes, wherever we can find. So there is certainly one of the places where we see John's originality and his creativity. Another place we could point to is the very journey between both of those, the process of growth, purification, transformation. John plots that for us, not from the point of view of this is what you must do or not do. It is not a set of instructions John gives. We don't need that. What he gives is a way of understanding the experience. Because ultimately it is a work of God. It's not our work. But as a way of living and understanding the experience. That for John is what's so important. Because for him the great tragedy is that so many people start on this journey but do not complete it, do not persevere. And they don't do so, not because they're unwilling to, but because they misunderstand or misinterpret what it is they're experiencing and cannot find somebody who will guide and help them and affirm them. So the misunderstanding of what one is experiencing, that's the area where John's teaching is so illuminating. Something else we could think about, John is perhaps most famous for his image of the dark night. And it has crept into our language and it is understood in all sorts of different ways, mostly nothing to do with John of the Cross. But his teaching in the dark night is certainly original and so helpful and so important for so many people. And perhaps the most important thing we've always got to remember about John of the Cross's teaching in the dark night is that whenever John uses images like darkness and night, it never means the absence of light. It always means the superabundance of light, the excessive light. The light of God is shining so brightly that we can see nothing. We're blinded by the light of God. We're plunged into deepest darkness. And of course, the closer one comes to God, then the darker it becomes. The deeper the darkness becomes. So what John is doing in his teaching in the dark night, he is teaching us how to live by faith, not by our knowledge or our understanding or our viewpoints or our other guidance or expectations we may have, because all of those are faulty and distorted. To live by faith, to live in the darkness of faith, to put one's reliance, one's trust totally upon God, that is perhaps among John's greatest contributions. And we could take that a step further, perhaps, in another way of seeing John's teaching and the originality of his teaching. And John tells us this himself, that he doesn't repeat what other people tell him, have spoken about the spiritual life, he said. He simply speaks about what others do not speak about. Or, as so often has been said about John of the Cross, he begins where other spiritual writers end. So John's teaching is very much to help and to guide and to support us when our spiritual lives take us beyond the limits of what we can know, what we can understand, what we can expect, what we can hope for, or what other people and other writers tell us. When we go beyond to that place where there are no maps, no signposts, no guidance, going beyond our securities, beyond what is safe, into that unknown, mysterious territory, which is the spiritual life. That's where John's genius, his original contribution, is really seen. Because there are no limits to where the spiritual life is going to take us to. Because it is relationship with God. And God does not have limits. There is no point of arrival. Finally, the final point I would make in trying to say a little bit about John's originality or creativity in the way that he teaches. All of the teaching work that we have from John, in a sense, is commentaries on his poems. And he much preferred to write poetry than prose, or to communicate his message in poetry rather than in prose. And he tells us, for example, in his prologue to the Spiritual Canticle, why he prefers this. And it's because, he said, spiritual things must always be taught in very general terms, so that everybody can draw from it what's right for them. It must never be limited or narrowed down to something that is not right for everyone, or not right for some people. We must never force or put a round peg into a square hole, for the want of a right expression. So when it comes to the spiritual life, each one of us is on a unique journey. Our spiritual lives are as unique as we are ourselves. And therefore, John teaches in a way that we can all draw something from this. We can draw something that speaks. And if it doesn't, leave it. It's okay. That there's a freedom, a flexibility, a breadth to the way that John speaks about the spiritual life. He goes way beyond other authors and teachers when it comes to this. And we see it also, of course, in the way that he advises and teaches spiritual directors. He can be quite hard on them at times. And he's particularly when they narrow things down, when we're dealing with the work of the Holy Spirit in a person's life. And therefore, we must always give the person breath. Let the Spirit work in a person in the way that the Spirit is, not in the way that we think the Spirit should be working, or according to somebody else's limited knowledge or understanding. Not only must we not impose our limits on ourselves, Even more importantly, we must not impose our limits of understanding or knowledge onto somebody else. So there's a method to John's teaching which is very liberating, very broad, recognizing that it is always the Holy Spirit who is at work, and we must not get in the Spirit's way or try to limit what the Spirit can do. So they are just a few things, perhaps pointers, to help us to see something of the originality of John the Cross's teaching and why he's declared a doctor of the church.